Hey, Coach, a lot of injuries there in that first half, but these guys are fighting hard in this league. Tell me what their message was at halftime, these guys.
Hey, it's a message. There ain't going to be nothing pretty about it. It's a four-quarter football game. We knew that coming in. It's next man up. It's going to be like fall camp. It ain't going to be about scheme. It's going to be bone on bone, shoot and shoot, belly button, nose on nose through these guys. For 60 minutes, that's what it's going to be.
I love it. Good luck, Coach.
The 26th head football coach of this great institution. Ladies and gentlemen, our new head football coach, Mel Tucker.
Our team, we will be physical.
Wilkins again gives to Benjamin. Hit and dropped in the backfield. Mustafa Johnson shooting through for Colorado.
Sometimes you just know. And I know that the young men in that room, they're hungry.
An interception thrown by Martinez. It's picked off by guess who?
I've never been in a game as a player or a coach that we weren't expected to win.
Blitz from Nebraska. Montez takes a shot. Drops it in to Chanel. Touchdown!
We're back for episode 6 of Shoulder to Shoulder Podcast, and the Buffs have pulled off an amazing win against Arizona State.
Woo!
Obviously, we're going to get into that one after the Pac-12 recap, but man, that was one of the most impressive wins I've ever seen a CU team have in the past, 15 years.
Yeah, I mean, that was just the amount of like grit and determination, all the things that went wrong in that game that I just felt like, okay, here comes the letdown, you know, and they were able to just keep fighting through it and somehow survive till the end.
Yeah, especially with all the setbacks, but that's for a little bit later. So we're going to get just straight into it. As always, if you want to send any questions, shoulder2shoulderpod@gmail.com. We actually do have two questions we're going to get to at the end of this episode.
All
we
right.
Actually had some people reach out, so we'll get to those. But to start off with the Pac-12 week 4, starting off with Cal taking down former head coach Mike McIntyre's Ole Miss Rebels. He's not the head coach, he's the defensive coordinator, but they took him down 28-20. And the ending of that game was absolutely hilarious. And also, it's probably devastating for Ole Miss fans.
Yeah. So, I mean, the ending aside, I guess, to get to the ending, we had a couple of interesting things. So, Cal, obviously, a defensive team. We talked about it before. Their offense might be holding them back. But, you know, in this game, their quarterback, Chase Garbers, had pretty much the game of his life. He had 357 yards, 4 touchdowns. 1 interception, very not Cal quarterback stat line there. Just for reference, in every game, every other game this year, all 3 others, he's never had more than 238 yards and 2 touchdowns. Also, that came in one game. Other than that one game where he had 238 yards and 2 touchdowns, he had less than 130 yards in the 2 others. So, and one of those was against North Texas. So it's not like he was playing some really good teams either.
Man, that is bad. Mike McIntyre's teams just seem to make it a habit of just giving quarterbacks career days.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, I don't know about his defense at Ole Miss, but that was pretty suspect that Cal was able to do that. So, 357, 4 touchdowns from a guy who's never come close to that before. It's not a good look, but, you know.
Not a good look at all.
Yeah, so that all set up for a pretty epic finish with Cal up 28-20 going into the final drive for Ole Miss. They threw a pass to the end zone. Looked like it could have been a touchdown, but it was marked at like the half yard or something right outside the end zone on third down. Clock was running down. It was like the last 10 seconds. And Ole Miss tried to run it in the end zone, and Cal stuffed him and stopped him, and the game was over. So, super questionable, weird clock management at the end, kind of screwed Ole Miss over, but Cal came out with a win.
Yeah, I think the weird clock management had to do with the fact that it's. I mean, to me, I even when I watched it live and I watched the replay, it seemed like he was across the goal line, just the angle of the camera. And so when, I mean, once they showed the replay, you could tell he wasn't quite there. But I mean, when you're doing that in live time, I think the coaching staff thought it was a touchdown, so they weren't worried about the clock. And then when they realized that they weren't signaling for a touchdown, the refs, they had to like hustle in there, and it was a really poor quarterback sneak.
Right. I mean, so that's what was weird to me. As I was watching it, I was thinking, like, can they even stop this to review? I mean, they only had 10 seconds, so they couldn't exactly wait around for the referees to say, like, hold on. You know, they had to make a play, because if it wasn't a touchdown, then they had to do something. But as soon as they ran that play, then you can't look at the play right before. So they were kind of in a tough spot there, Ole Miss. But yeah, they tried to do a quarterback sneak at the end, and it just got absolutely stuffed. I mean, it was Cal's defense kind of did their thing there. So
yeah, I'm curious, because I mean, I'm sure we've seen that before, but I don't know how that works. Obviously, if the booth thinks that something is deemed worthy of a review, they can signal it down. But I mean, what happens there, since the refs, like, the clock was running? Do they just stop the clock and then the play resumes? It's like a dead ball, or I guess I'm not.
Yeah,
I figure that's what would happen. But
I would imagine if they stopped it there to have a review, they would just stop the clock, and then it would be a matter of Ole Miss lining back up, and then they started up and they snapped the ball real quick. But who knows? I don't know. I mean, that was a good stand for the defense for Cal, and it ultimately won in the game, controversy or not. I did think overall, though, Cal's defense, which is definitely their strength, I kind of felt like it played okay, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't know how you felt about it. I thought it was a decent showing, but it hasn't necessarily been like the dominance that they've been showing early on in the season.
Yeah, no, it wasn't great. They did hold the Matt Corral or Coral, I can never remember how to pronounce his name. They only held him to 266 yards and like 6.5 yard average. So he wasn't playing out of his mind. Right,
he wasn't efficient.
But the team, Ole Miss rushing average as a team, they were averaging 4.7 yards a carry, which for a Cal defense, that's pretty high actually. So I don't know if they just had maybe an off day. But the thing about defenses is I think defenses always travel well, whereas offenses can – I can understand a slow start on offense. Right. I didn't expect Cal to have any sort of offense anyways, but they somehow did.
Yeah, magically.
And, yeah, so, I mean, maybe it's just one of those weird coincidences where the defense didn't travel. Maybe it wasn't quite up for the game, and the offense somehow was. So you never know, but either way, Ole Miss winning that game – or no, Ole Miss losing that game, it makes the Pac-12 look a little bit better, and it makes reaffirms the fact that the top 4 or 5 in the SEC are really, really good, and they're pretty mediocre, just like every other conference after that.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I mean, I think it was a big win for the Pac-12 in that it just kind of shows the depth of the conference. I mean, Cal is ranked 15 now in the most recent AP poll that just came out today. We're recording this on Sunday. So, yeah, it was a big game, I think, for like how the national media could look at the conference coming up, which is good, because the way that the season is shaping up right now, I feel like the Pac-12 could really just beat up on each other. So the more ranked teams we've got, the better it'll be for everyone else in the long run.
Yeah, because right now we had, what, 6 or 7 last week?
We had 6 last week, and I believe we have 5 this week.
Yeah, so who did we lose in the top 25 here?
Washington State.
Of course,
and Washington State. And ASU.
So we had 7 last week then?
No, because we gained...
USC?
Yes, again.
That's who it was. Yeah, okay. So overall, we lost. It's a -1 on the week to week, but like we said already, that's a pretty big win for the Pac-12 going into SEC. I think that's what's big about it too, is it was going into Mississippi and winning that game. Yeah,
for sure, big win against the SEC. We don't have many of those.
No, not at all. But actually, it's funny that you mentioned that, because I saw someone mention this, and I haven't had a chance to actually confirm it. So I'll kind of look it up as we're going along. But I saw that the Pac-12's conference record or matchup record against the SEC in the last 10 years, the Pac-12 was actually winning.
Hmm.
So I'd have to like confirm that, but that very well could just be, you know, the top or the higher tier Pac-12 teams beating up on the lower tier SEC teams, which wouldn't really mean that much. But right. I don't know. I'll have to look that up as we're going here. Yeah. So to get on to the next one, Washington took care of business against BYU. It was pretty out of control pretty right from the beginning. It was, I mean, at the end of the first quarter, it was 21-3. Then BYU actually kind of made sort of a comeback. It was 24-12 going into the half. And then from there, Washington just took off again. And Jacob Eason looked really solid. He was very efficient. He only missed four of his 28 attempts, averaging like 10 yards an attempt. And I mean, he played pretty well. He played kind of, he's just doing things that Jake Browning couldn't do previously. And that's giving Washington quite a bit of an edge. It's just that they kind of blew that one against Cal, and that's really what's going to, I think, hold them back for the rest of this year as far as bowls or playoff appearances can go.
Yeah, I mean, look, Eason looked really good. I think outside of maybe one, that one throw that he had that was the pick where he just totally forced it. I mean, he was pretty much cruising the whole way. You know, three touchdowns and it made it look easy. I mean, it was an impressive win for Washington, beating up on a BYU team that had given other Pac-12 teams some problems. So, you know, beat USC. So, it was big for them, Definitely was, you know, it was at BYU. I think it was pretty impressive. The other thing that I thought was interesting for Washington, they didn't actually have their starting running back in this game, but their backups, I mean, really killed BYU. McGrew had 110 yards on 18 carries, and Newton had 80 yards and a touchdown on 16 carries. So they look pretty stacked there. Their offense looks like it's really humming along nicely here at this point in the season.
Yeah, anytime you can put up 45 points and you have a defense that's a Chris Peterson-led defense, I think you're going to win a large majority of your games. But actually, now that I'm thinking about it, going back to what I said about their chances at the playoff, if it's possible with the Cal loss, I mean, if Cal keeps it up there, I mean, you know, if you look at the end of the season, it's Washington has one loss, Cal has one loss, you know, whoever gets into the Pac-12 championship, they're going to have a win against a probably highly ranked team. So, I mean, really, maybe it doesn't really hurt their chances if they can keep it up.
Well, yeah, I mean, so basically they just want Cal to win as many games as possible, with the exception of they do need, I think at this point, Washington's going to need Cal to lose at least two games, right? Because the Cal will have the edge on them for the championship
game. Head-to-head.
So if Cal drops two, but yeah, stays like ranked in the teens somewhere, I think knowing that people would probably consider that it was a weird loss in a game that was thunder lightning delay for hours and then you know, played and finished at like 2 o'clock in the morning and they lost on a last second field goal, I think Washington would have a chance if they were able to run the table, but I think that's looking like it's going to be harder and harder to do for the teams in the Pac-12.
Yeah. I mean, I'm actually, the way I'm looking at it right now, I think Washington and Cal in the North have a much better chance of running the table than any team in the South. I think the North, you know, Washington, Cal, and Oregon are all good. And then after what we saw from Washington or State, and maybe it was a fluke, but the North, like after those three teams, seems to drop off significantly.
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to look exactly at their schedules and see like who's playing who where and stuff. But it'll be very interesting to see how that thing shakes out up in the North. I wouldn't be surprised if we have a couple of teams end up with like two losses at the top there. But yeah, I'm with you. After this last game against UCLA, I kind of feel like Washington State might drop behind them, and Stanford and Oregon State are obviously at the bottom of that, I would say.
Yeah, they are. I think unless Stanford really does something to figure out their offense, they're gonna struggle for the rest of the season, because yes, they just really can't put points on the board.
Yes.
So Washington took care of business with BYU, and then the next game up was Oregon taking care of Stanford, as we mentioned. And this one was actually a little bit closer than I thought. It was, I mean, it was. Did I pull up the wrong game here? No, yeah, I did pull up the wrong box score. But I was gonna say that is not the final score. Yeah, I mean, Oregon took care of Stanford. Was it 21-6?
Yes, it was. I believe it was.
Yes, okay. 21-6. Yeah, there we go. Now I've got the right box score. I think I was a bit surprised that Oregon only be able to put up 21 points after what UCF did to Stanford last week.
Yeah, so I mean, I would say Oregon wasn't overly impressive offensively anyway. It looked like they had a couple of drives where they scored quickly, and I thought, like, okay, here we go. Here comes the blowout, you know. But it definitely looked like there was a little bit of I don't know. It just looked like they weren't really in rhythm at all. They had some random touchdowns. I mean, Herbert, his final stat line looks okay. 259 yards, 3 touchdowns, no interceptions. It's a solid day. But yeah, after what UCF did last week, I would have thought Oregon would blow them out a little bit more than they did. That said, I mean, their defense played really well on Stanford. I don't think Stanford's offense is like a force to be reckoned with or anything like that, but the Oregon D line looks good. I mean, 5 sacks, 8 tackles for loss. So they, I think they definitely have a strength there. But yeah, I mean, Stanford isn't an opponent anymore that a team like Oregon has to fear. So I almost feel like maybe they overlooked him a little bit because they just didn't look like they were playing at the top of their game. But that said, all of that said about Oregon, I mean, KJ Costello was held to 120 yards and an interception. So the Stanford quarterback. So it was still a rough go for that Stanford offense, which I think is a definite thing that we're going to see from the Oregon defense for the rest of the year. I think they're pretty legit.
Yeah, I think they are too. Not to discredit them because they're going up against Stanford. I just think that they're actually going to be a pretty hard nosed defense throughout the year. And they're not going to give up a ton of points. The thing that was, The thing that stuck out to me was, Kayvon Thibodeau, the number one recruit in the nation, finally got his part in a half sack in that game.
Yeah.
So it was kind of exciting to see. He started off relatively slow. He's only had, you know, looking at his year stats, he's only got 6 total tackles. But it was just interesting to see that he's finally starting to get in there and get into the action. Because he, in high school, he was just unbelievably dominant. And I think a lot of the criticism was that he was a little bit lazy. So I don't know if that's kind of playing into why he started off so slow. But I was just excited to see him get in there and actually get some pressure on the quarterback.
Yep. I think it was a game that wasn't super entertaining. So I think things like that were kind of like the most that you could take out of it for sure. I mean, it was exciting to see some of those guys. Overall, you know, Oregon did what they wanted to do. They had a road win against Stanford. So they took care of business. It wasn't exactly like their prettiest all around best win, but it will look good on the schedule.
Yep. So the next game up was UCLA and Washington State, which I kind of wish I could have watched the entire game just because it was going on during a lot of the CU game.
Right, right.
But I just remember following it along as the CU game was going on. And by the end of – or by like halfway through the third quarter or something, or maybe it was like 5 minutes into the third quarter, I stopped following it because I was like, well, this game's over. It was like 49-17 or something.
Yeah, they were up 32 in the third quarter. I think that was the peak.
Yeah.
Washington State was.
Yeah, and so I finished watching the CU game after I was completely pumped. I was losing my mind. And then I like calmed down and I was like, all right, let's see what's going on in the rest of Pac-12, see what's still going. And I turned the TV to UCLA and Washington State, and all of a sudden it's a 3-point game. And I had to double check that I wasn't like crazy and they weren't down 32 because I couldn't believe that they had actually made that comeback.
Yeah, so this is going to be an interesting one, I think, to look back on, because now all of a sudden you're looking at a team like Washington State that was ranked, what were they, 19, I think, going into this game?
Yeah, they're 19.
So, you know, they had some hype behind them. They had looked good. Their offense was standard Mike Leach offense, just tearing everybody to shreds. And UCLA had, I don't think they'd scored more than 14 points in any of their other games. So this had blowout potential all the way through. And yeah, to see UCLA come back from down 32 and win 67-63 was miraculous. I mean, there was no defense in this game played whatsoever. There was 1,377 total yards of offense between the two teams. So it was really, it was like classic Pac-12 after dark freakiness. It was exciting. I mean, a lot of people are saying it's like the game of the year or whatever, but I mean, it, which is crazy because UCLA like looks terrible, but hey, that, you know, credit to them. They pulled off a win. They had a huge comeback, giant comeback. But I think really it's kind of left us with more questions about who these teams are than like real answers.
Yeah. I think the fact, yeah. Cause like we said, they were up 49-17 and is it on, I mean, a lot of it's got to, you got to put a lot of blame on the coaching staff for Washington State for not getting a handle on it, but is the Washington State defense that bad? And they were just kind of, you know, humming along in the first half, or did UCLA make some adjustments at halftime and the offense is like starting to hum now? I mean, Dorian Thompson-Robinson threw for 500 yards and 5 touchdowns, which seems like nothing compared to Anthony Gordon's 9 touchdowns.
Yeah, that's obscene. He threw 9 touchdowns and they lost.
And I had to look it up, but I think I was looking it up. Is that, and I couldn't, I wasn't positive. Is that the record or not? That's not the record for TDs in a game, is it? Throwing
touchdowns? Not for all of college football, but it is for the Pac-12, I believe. I believe it was a Pac-12 record and Washington State record. I think, who's the guy? He's like a NFL journeyman quarterback. Oh, God, what's his name? He played for the Broncos last year, I think, right?
Case Keenum, yes,
maybe? Yeah, Case Keenum. I think he has the record when he was in college, I'm pretty sure.
That's,
I think it's like 10 or something like that.
That's, I mean, that's ridiculous to throw 9 touchdowns and lose a game.
Right.
I mean, that is demoralizing,
right.
I'm sure.
So, I mean, look, so let's get into that, right? How does this team, how does this quarterback throw 9 touchdowns and still lose the game? Well, they, for one thing, they turned the ball over like they didn't want it. So they lost the turnover battle 6-1. two of those were interceptions by the quarterback. But, I mean, really, if you just look, if you look at these drives, so I believe it, there was one point UCLA's down 18. They had already started their comeback. They're down 18. They were down more than that. They were down 24-49. They scored a touchdown on one play after a fumble. Washington State, so that took 7 seconds. Washington State went 5 plays, had to punt. UCLA got the ball, went 94 yards on 1 pass in 13 seconds and scored. Washington State got the ball back, fumbled. UCLA got the ball, went 4 plays, 51 yards, touchdown. And at that point, they're down by 3. So all of those things happened, I think it was a total of like 5 minutes. They completely flipped it. So that's kind of how a comeback like that happens, where, I mean, UCLA had a couple of kick return touchdowns. Like, you need some fluky stuff to make up 32 points. And Washington State really just kind of blew it. I don't think there's any other way to say it. They just turned the ball over and turned the ball over and gave up a special teams touchdown, turned the ball over. So, and then when they finally settled down, you know, it's too late. You're like in the middle of a shootout at that point. So,
yeah. I mean, for Anthony Gordon, he wasn't really the problem. I mean, you're throwing it 61 times, 2 interceptions isn't that right, bad.
Yeah. What are you going to do?
Especially when you're throwing 9 touchdowns. So you can't really put much of this on him. You got to really just look at how many fumbles they had and the special teams issues. And then UCLA just seemed to take advantage of every single opportunity they were given.
I mean, their last two drives in the fourth quarter both ended on fumbles after one play. One of them, Gordon completed a pass to Winston Jr., and he went 14 yards and then fumbled at the end of it. That's the one that gave UCLA the touchdown. And then the last drive was a sack fumble. But, you know, I mean, sack fumble is kind of hard to blame on the quarterback, but two fumbles under your last two drives in crunch time of the fourth quarter, that's not going to get it done.
Yeah, it's just, I think it's just one of those fluky games. And kind of like you mentioned before, I don't think this gives us really any indication as to how Washington State's going to do for the rest of the year or how UCLA is going to do the rest of the year. I still think UCLA is a pretty bad football team that just happened to catch a lot of breaks from a team that didn't really seem like it wanted to win. And this, for those of you that do not follow Washington State much, which I don't assume you do, Mike Leach has kind of always had like one or two games a year where he just, his team comes out and just like does something stupid and loses a game they shouldn't. And this, I think, was his 2019 version of that.
Yeah, he definitely seems to have a habit of doing that at least once a year. So maybe that was it. Maybe this is a one-off where they lose a weird game. But I definitely would be worried about that Washington State defense at this point for sure. Definitely worried about like their ability to hang on to the ball and not turn the ball over, because I feel like that tends to be contagious with teams. They start turning the ball over in a game and then it gets in their mind and it's hard to stop. So, you know, it'll be really interesting to see. Washington State plays Utah next weekend. So I think it's going to be really fascinating to see how that game turns out.
Yeah. And speaking of Utah, we'll kind of just transition straight into the USC-Utah game. USC somehow won this game. Obviously, both of us lost that bet. And
hey, the only they did one, it with the only one that we missed. Okay, we were 5 for 6 last week. So yep. You know what? I'll take one loss.
Not bad at all. But the crazy thing about it is USC won this with their third string quarterback, and he pretty much played the entire game. Keaton Slovis only threw two attempts. He completed them both, but threw two attempts before he was taken out of the game, and it looked like a concussion. So hopefully he's all right, but. Matt Fink came in, who wasn't he in the transfer portal?
Yeah, he was at one point. He was looking to transfer. I think he's, because do you know, is he a senior? Maybe a junior? He's been a backup for a while on that USC roster. And when he got beat out again this year, I think he decided he was going to transfer. And for whatever reason, he changed his mind. I think he was interviewed and he said something about, I thought about it and I decided, why would I leave USC where we have some of the best athletes in college football to play somewhere else where the team would be worse or something. So interesting choice, but it ended up working out for him this time.
It definitely did. The crazy thing about it, and you and I were texting back and forth about this game as it was going, USC kind of just gave up all hope of running the football. They ran the ball 22 times and only gained 13 yards. Obviously, that includes a sack on Matt Fink, but that was only a 6-yard sack or 6 yards worth of sacks. And so that's not they couldn't even get a yard per carry. They pretty much just abandoned the run, and Utah knew it was coming and they still couldn't stop it.
Right. I mean, that definitely seemed like it was by design because they were coming out just throwing right away. So I mean, I know Utah has this incredible defensive line, and I think that was just how USC decided to attack it. They just said, forget it. We're going to throw a bunch of short, quick passes, and we're going to get them frustrated that way. And it, to their credit, it seemed like it worked. I mean, they have the wide receivers to play a passing game like that, and their offense is geared so that you can just throw the ball all over the field. But pretty ballsy move considering you're working with your third string quarterback. But I really think that was the only way that they were going to win this game, because I don't think their running game is that strong. And against a Utah defensive line that's probably still, I think, one of the better ones in the country, I don't think they had much of a chance there. So I think they pretty much just said, well, if we're going to win, we're going to have to just throw it all over the field. And that's what they did.
Yeah. And I got to feel bad a little bit for Tyler Huntley. I mean, he didn't play like he did what he normally does. He plays good enough for the team to win. I mean, I don't think he's ever going to be that guy that just completely takes over a game, but I mean, he went 22 for 30 for 210 yards. He threw a touchdown, so nothing like Herculean, but he, at the end of the game, I mean, he was just extending plays as much as he could and trying to keep them in the game, and at the end it didn't work out. And I think a lot of the reason that the game kind of went USC's favor is because Zach Moss got hurt. He ended up separating his AC. I don't know where that is right. Exactly.
They're starting running back. It's a shoulder. It's in his shoulder. It's a shoulder injury.
Okay. So I mean, he got hurt, and I feel bad for him because he got hurt at the end of last year as well and missed the last like four games. So just a bad stroke of luck for him. Hopefully it's not like too serious, but I have no idea how serious those AC separations can get.
Yeah, I mean, he could be out for a while. It totally depends on how bad it was. I mean, that stuff, sometimes it can need surgery, sometimes, you know, they can work through it if it's just a pain management thing, but you never know. I guess that'll get cleared up more as time goes on. My real question with this game is Matt Fink actually good? because his line, the USC third string quarterback, was 351 yards, 3 touchdowns, 1 interception, which, you know, by itself, you're thinking, yeah, no duh, this guy's good. He played a great defense in Utah and he put up those numbers. I mean, that's impressive. But when I was looking back at the touchdowns that he threw, so his first touchdown, deep ball, if you look at it, the Utah corner totally had it covered 100%. I mean, I thought maybe it was going to get picked. He was going stride for stride with the USC wide receiver, tripped and fell, and USC wide receiver wide open caught it. So that was unfortunate. Second touchdown, he escaped a sack, which was impressive because it looked like he was totally screwed. Escaped, threw the ball up, underthrew his receiver by probably like 5 yards. I mean, everyone in the air, they just all stopped, threw it into double coverage, and then that USC wide receiver core, another one, he just jumped in between two guys and came down with it for a touchdown. So, I mean, pretty lucky. And then the third one was another touchdown that was slightly underthrown with two Utah defensive backs in the area, and the USC receiver, again, he just was the only one looking at the ball, and he came up in the middle and caught it and ran the rest of the way for a touchdown. So you're basically talking about a guy who had three really big plays that were just made by his guys out jumping the Utah defense. And I think that says two things. One, it'll be interesting to see what happens going forward, especially if he's still the quarterback going ahead. I don't know how injured Keaton Slovis is, but when they play a team that maybe has a little bit better secondary. And the other thing it says is, I kind of think Utah secondary might be a little bit of a problem. They seem like they have talented guys, but they didn't. I mean, they looked totally outclassed against USC.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually going to pose that question to you. I was going to say, is this more of an indictment on Utah's secondary, or is USC's quarterback depth just that insane? And I think you kind of hit it on the head. I think Utah's secondary might be a little bit more suspect than people initially thought going into the season.
I mean, I think their defensive line has been so good, it kind of masks some of those problems. You know, I mean, when you're getting pressure on the quarterback all the time, you don't have to, your secondary doesn't get tested. So I think that's definitely a possibility. And the way USC played this game, you know, Utah didn't have as much of a chance to get pressure. And when they did, to Matt Fink's credit, he was able to escape and extend plays and throw the ball down the field. I also think, outside of whether USC has quarterback depth or whether Utah's DBs are suspect, I think the other thing that we have to recognize is USC's wide receiver core is very, very talented. I mean, those guys are just incredible athletes, and they were just bailing him out left and right, making incredible plays, basically winning every jump ball. So they were making it happen.
I mean, realistically, the way that the receivers for USC played today, it looked very similar to the game against CU last year, where JT Daniels was just throwing it up, and it was basically playing 500 with the CU secondary, and they were winning those battles last year. It looked very similar. It was kind of giving me some PTSD. Thankfully, it wasn't us playing, but
yeah,
it was. I mean, overall, now there's no undefeated team left in the pack besides Cal. Cal is the remaining undefeated.
Yep, and I would be surprised if they stay that way. So it's going to be interesting. I mean, really, the only other thing I had to say about this game is it was pretty, aside from the weirdness of USC winning it at all, it was pretty sloppy. I noticed that both teams struggled with penalties. And I'm not sure if that's going to be something that's a problem for them going forward, but Utah had 16 penalties for 120 yards and USC had 11 for 117. So that is pretty obscene.
That's ridiculous. And coming from a Kyle Whittingham team too in Utah, that's kind of surprising.
Yeah. So I don't know if that's going to be something to look for going forward or not. I don't know if it's a one-off for Utah, but it really did. I mean, their offense, I think that was one of the things that held them back, was they had a lot of offensive penalties. They had some holding calls, it hurt them for sure.
It definitely did. Quick note before we head into the ASU game. Let's see, isn't it Josh Fallow, who is the, I believe, brother of Nuamosu Fallow? SCU linebacker, made his first reception for USC this year. And so that is about the only time I'll be happy for anything USC related. Because he's related to a CU guy, so you got to be a little happy for him.
Yeah. Shout out
Josh Fallow. So to get into the meat of what we really wanted to get to here, meat and potatoes, as Mel Tucker says, the ASU Colorado game was exciting from start to finish. There was not a moment in that game where I think even a casual fan would have been bored.
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, so at least for generally how we felt during this game, right? I mean, I weirdly felt pretty comfortable for a lot of it. I don't know why. I don't know if it's like Mel Tucker or what, but you know, I was sitting there on the couch watching this game and I felt good. I think it was because no matter what, I knew that this team was battling through a lot of adversity throughout the game. But I mean, it was a gutsy win. And I think you can really see the kind of effect that Mel Tucker is having on the team just mentally. I mean, to battle through that game after all the injuries that they had, all those problems, was very impressive.
Yeah. And the thing that obviously was, I think, the most impressive was how well the team responded after getting so many guys hurt. But before we touch on that, I was kind of weirdly not confident, but I was just calm watching this game. And normally, like, I would be like heart racing, like freaking out, like can't stand still kind of deal in a game like this. But maybe Mel Tucker has just such a calming effect on the team that it somehow transitioned over to the fans. Because I really wasn't ever like freaking out. I was never sure that CU was going to win, but I mean, CU popped up 14-0 to start the game, and then Arizona State outscored them in the second quarter to make, but I mean, still CU was still leading 24-21 going into the halftime. But you know, after getting up 14-0, it kind of called back to 2017 against Arizona State back when we were back there, and CU was up, I think, 14-0, and then Shea Fields had a wide open drop on a deep ball, so Arizona State was able to come back and win that game. So it was oddly reminiscent of that same kind of start, but CU was able to hold on, and I think that's just really a huge credit to the coaching staff mentality that they brought in. And this team obviously has zero quit in them.
Yeah, clearly has zero quit. I mean, just to touch on that, like if you're looking at just the guys who are injured at some point in this game, you had Laviska Shenault, I mean, our number one offensive player, one of the best offensive players in the league,
in the country.
Mustafa Johnson, probably our most impactful defensive player, definitely one of the best guys in the league again on defense. You had Delrick Abrams, starting cornerback, Chris Miller, other starting cornerback, Onu was hurt at some point. Mangum was hurt, and they were already starting this game without their starting safety, Aaron Maddox. So, I mean, you're talking about the best player on offense, one of our really great running backs, who did, to his credit, I mean, he came back in, he toughed it out, but clearly limited his carries because Fontenot was like a absolute workhorse in this game. And then like half of our starting defense all out, and they were able to hang on. And early too. I mean, it wasn't like late in the game. It was, these guys were going down early in the game. So,
yeah, it really kind of, Mel Tucker mentioned it in a halftime like interview.
One of the greatest halftime interviews I've ever heard.
Oh, it was 23 seconds long. And after those 23 seconds, I was like, where's the wall? I'll run through it. Show me the wall. And he was talking about, you know, the next man up mentality. And I'll plug that for you guys at the beginning of the episode, which you all have already heard at this point. So you'll hear that. But he's talking about the next man up mentality, and it really kind of showed, because you saw guys like KJ Trujillo, him getting his first playing time. You saw Mark Perry getting playing time. I mean, you saw guys that to this point had either not played meaningful snaps or had not played at all, getting in on the defensive side of the ball to fill in for these guys. And I mean, say what you want about CU defense. Obviously, it's been giving up yards like crazy, but they've given up 31 points. I mean, that's the highest amount. They've been giving up basically 31 points a game. And I mean, that's in the, today's day and age of football, that's not terrible. That's, you're still going to be able to win a good amount of games giving up 31 points.
I mean, with our offense, that we can win those games. We can survive those. It would be great if they could get that number down, obviously. But, I mean, look, they actually, in the second half, after all these injuries, they came back, held ASU to only 10 points in the second half. I mean, really, outside of one touchdown in the second half, that credit to Jaden Daniels was like a beautiful, beautiful throw, and it was well defended. So there's just what sometimes you just, you know, perfect offense beats good defense. But I mean, they played well. The second half, they came out, they stepped up, they limited them to 10 points, just the touchdown, the field goal. They had an interception. They forced them to turn it over on downs. And they punted twice. So it's pretty impressive that with all those problems, all those injuries, they still were able to make halftime adjustments, and they were still able to limit the other offense that had really been having a lot of success against them in the first half.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, it was just great to see the halftime adjustments remained in place. But Mel Tucker, after the Air Force game, I mean, he owned up to it, and he said, we got to figure out as a coaches why we're starting slow, and that can't happen if we want to win games. And they came out and they started fast. I mean, they went up 14-0, like I said, and then they were still winning at halftime 24-21. That's pretty much all you can ask for when the first three games you came out looking flat and like out of either you weren't prepared or mentally not like all there.
Yeah. I mean, they came out fast, which was amazing. I mean, to see those first two CU drives were like exactly like what we had anticipated for the whole year. You know, they looked crisp. They looked like they just were really connected and really cruised down the field, converted a couple of third downs. And they were, I mean, it was, the first drive was 75 yards and the second one was 70, I think. So, I mean, they were serious, serious drives to start off that game and go up 14-0. And if it wasn't for a fumbled kickoff return, I think they could have still rebounded and gone up 21-7. They just had some, you know, they had some bad luck. And, you know, they're able to just really fight off some adversity, and the offense looked good. They scored in every quarter, so there's not a lot to complain about. I think if we were nitpicking a little bit, you could say the second half, I felt like the offense, and we talked about it a little bit, it seemed a little more conservative. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, no, it definitely seemed more conservative, especially I want to say the second to last drive that CU had, where I think we ran it three times in a row, if I'm not mistaken. I could be completely wrong on that, but either that or it was two runs.
I think it was two runs and a quick. They were going to throw like a wide receiver screen to KD or something, and I think someone missed a block, so he got stopped at the line of scrimmage. Otherwise, it would have worked, but you know, it was more horizontal passing. So
yeah, and I don't know if that was Jay Johnson's doing or if Mel Tucker kind of wanted to slow it down and be a bit more conservative. But I mean, they were moving the ball. The offense was moving the ball, so I don't know why you slow it down. And I mean, if you look at the box score, 14 points first, 10 in the second, 7 in the third, and then 3 in the fourth. So obviously, you know, the offense started off hot and kind of just went on a little slight downward slope. But I was a little curious about why it seemed so conservative, because you're not the first person I've heard say that, and I think it's a pretty commonly shared opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I get it. You're playing with a lead for much of the game. You know, you're trying to be careful, especially in the final moments. But you know, we had some guys running the offense who were playing really well. And I mean, if we're gonna get into like specific guys that impressed, Steven Montez, I mean, he had a hell of a game. So he had a really rough game against Air Force. But, you know, we were talking about it on the last podcast, and I said he's going to have a game soon where he just absolutely goes off. And I think he pretty much did that here. 337 yards, 3 touchdowns, no interceptions, played really well, controlled the game the whole time. So you'd think with a quarterback playing like that, maybe they'd have a little more trust. But, yeah, I think it was just a matter of, you know, they're trying to be careful, trying to play with the lead. And they're trying not to do too much, especially at the end. You know, you're trying to waste some clock, and you have a kicker who's just absolute money. So I think they were just being conservative because of that.
Yeah, I think you're right. But it was really awesome to see the offensive line, especially towards the end of the game, really start to take over. I mean, aside from that last drive when those two runs didn't, or second to last drive, when, or maybe I'm thinking the third to last drive. I know at one point we didn't convert because Montez threw it over Maurice Bell's head.
Right. Yeah. Which is one of the only like off target throws he had all game, and it still hit him in the hands. It would have been a tough catch, but it still, he got his hands on it. You know, it wasn't like what we saw at Air Force where he was just overthrowing guys by 5-10 yards.
Yeah. But I mean, the offensive line really started to take over. I wish I could see, you know, a quarter by quarter breakdown of the yards per carry, because I'm sure it took a big leap from quarter three to quarter four. And that's when Alex Fontenot really started to, you know, earn his badge, so to say. And that was impressive. And I guess, as you said, players that impressed. I don't know who to be more impressed with between Steven Montez, Tony Brown, and then the entire offensive line as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, they were all awesome. Tony Brown, like, I mean, that dude's my hero. I'm going to be completely honest. That guy just makes big catch after big catch. And, you know, he had 3 career touchdowns coming into this game. So to go for 150 and 3 touchdowns in this one game, really stepped up with LaVisca being out. And I mean, it was impressive. He made some catches that were really impressive. He had that diving catch in the end zone that he somehow kept the ball off the ground while he's rolling onto his back. And then he had another catch where he was totally covered by a corner and just was able to get a little bit of separation and corral that ball in. So, I mean, he was really good. And he and Montez were clearly on the same page. I mean, the other touchdown he had was Montez extending the play and Tony Brown just reading the defense and seeing an open pocket open up and just finding the open space. So that's the kind of stuff you really like to see, and the kind of thing that I think going forward is something that we could definitely be seeing on a week-to-week basis with those two.
Yeah, and just kind of touch a little bit on those touchdowns a little bit more. As you mentioned, you know, Montez broke out of the pocket and Tony Brown just read the defense and broke. I mean, that was just pure. He remembered how he was supposed to do that release from practice, and it just, like, it was so natural. Like, he didn't think twice. He took off and Montez found him perfectly for, I mean, it was an easy touchdown for him. The diving catch, just pure athleticism. And then I feel like we said this in the Nebraska game too. The third touchdown he had was, I mean, that again, an NFL throw by Montez and an NFL catch by Tony Brown. It was one of the most beautiful pitch and catches I've seen from a CU quarterback and receiver in a while.
Yeah, I mean, he's been incredibly impressive. I don't know what else to say about him. He's been awesome, and it just shows you how deep our group of wide receivers is, because he was considered, what, third string? I mean, not third string, maybe our number three wide receiver.
Like our third option guy
between him and, like, Stanley in the slot. But, I mean, he just played out of his mind, so that was awesome to see.
Yeah, and I think, I don't think this is me having some black and gold glasses on. I legitimately think the way he's playing so far this season, he's going to earn himself either a late round draft pick, but if he's not drafted in late rounds, he will be on a roster. I'm almost positive of it in the NFL come this time next year.
Yeah, I mean, if he can keep this up, who knows? But he's been very impressive, and I feel like teams would be dumb not to take a look at him. I mean, it's not like NFL teams haven't had some success picking up undrafted rookies out of Colorado. You know what I mean? So, shout out Philip Lindsay. Yeah, so, I mean, those were all on offense. Offense played great. The one guy I really wanted to highlight on defense was Darian Rakestraw. So that guy comes in, he gets his first start at safety, filling in for Aaron Maddox, and he comes in, he leads the team in tackles, and he has that unbelievable interception. I mean, he made a diving catch on an interception. He looked like the wide receiver. I honestly couldn't tell what was... For a second, I didn't even know what happened, but he just made an amazing play on the ball, and he really stepped up in a game where they absolutely needed him to step up. So,
yeah, I wouldn't be shocked. I mean, maybe if he continues to play like this, I wouldn't really be shocked if, when Maddox is healthy again, if he stays in as the starter. Maddox, I think, has always been good at the run support, but he definitely had some deficiencies in the coverage aspects of the safety role. And Rakestraw, I mean, he blew some coverages too. There were a couple of times where he had a guy streaking across the middle.
Few of those where guys were streaking across the middle, and I'm not sure if it was him or if Landman was supposed to pick someone up. There were a couple of those, like, that we've seen in weeks previous, where it looks like there's some miscommunication or guys made mistakes on defensive, like on their specific roles. But, you know, I just thought overall he played better than I expected him to. I'll put it that way.
Yeah. And while you're mentioning, guys, while you mentioned Land going across the middle, before I get to Landman, I think overall we did see less of a coverage breakdown from Rakestraw specifically from that role, right, of that safety, right, role. I think, yeah. So, I mean, it'll be curious to see if Maddox comes back, you know, in 4 or 5 weeks, if he actually does win the starting job back, because Rakestraw impressed last night, and there's no doubt about that. I mean, I would say he was definitely the defensive MVP of last night.
Yeah, I think him and, you know, really the defense as a whole, just to keep going, like with the guys that they lost, just to not miss a step and keep going, keep battling, play for play. So that was impressive. That was impressive.
Yeah, and you know, it's not all sunshine and daisies. I did want to bring up Nate Landman. Obviously, is getting his tackles, so his stats don't really show it, but he's looked kind of, you know, average this year, and it sucks to say that because he was so dominant last year. But and I have no idea if it's the offense or if maybe he's got so much responsibility in the defensive play calling that he's just kind of slow and struggling a little bit right now. But he just doesn't look like the Nate Landman of last year
at, yeah, all. I mean, I think the role in this defense for him has changed a bit. I know coverage responsibilities were never his strong suit, so I think he's just kind of responsible for more of those now. I don't know 100% that this is how it works, but there was at least one play where Arizona State, they basically send a couple receivers deep and they clear out the left side, and they had a wide receiver come across from the right to the left, and he was just wide open in the middle. And you could see on the play, Nate Landman goes in like he's supposed to blitz, and then he kind of turns around and sees the receiver running across, and he realizes like, oh shoot, I'm supposed to be covering that guy, and then turns around and runs back towards him. But, you know, at that point it's too late. And I kind of think that there's something going on in the middle, depending on how the play develops, where one of those two linebackers is supposed to blitz and the other one is supposed to drop back in coverage. And I don't know if that's where the miscommunication is coming. But it's clear, like Mel Tucker's defense, there's a lot that they're relying on the guys to make the right decisions in the middle of the play. So I think he's just struggled with coverage. I think he's still the same run stopper. He still makes really solid, he's still a really solid tackler. And when the other team's running the ball and Nate Landman's there, I still feel good about him making that tackle. So he still has his strengths. I just think the weakness of his game is showing up more.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And while we're still on the defense, as a whole, the defensive line, while they didn't overly dominate, you know, as far as like a pass rush goes, considering they lost Mustafa really early, I think they played pretty decently. I mean, Jeremiah Doss got his first playing time of the year, and he came in and filled in for Mustafa. And I mean, he didn't do horribly. There were a couple times where, I mean, I think, you know, Mustafa would have gotten a bit more pressure on the quarterback, but I think Jeremiah Doss came in and played relatively well, considering he was thrust into that situation and he hadn't really played at all in the
year. Yeah, I agree. I mean, like the defensive line, their numbers don't really pop out at you, but, you know, I mean, you know, Benjamin, he's a really great running back. He did have 2 touchdowns, but it took him a while in this game to really get going. And in years past, I mean, he breaks through the line. He scores at least one long running touchdown, it seems like, every time that we've played him. So, you know, they kind of made it hard on him. They made him work for it. And I think that's like a big credit to the defensive line right there. And, you know, they only had 1 sack. I think it was from Terrence Lang, but it was a big sack, so
it was crucial.
It was crucial. They came up big when we needed them to, so can't complain there.
Yeah, and that's part of the other thing I wanted to mention is that the defensive line started to get more and more pressure as the game goes on, which I think is just more evidence that, you know, when Tucker said they're going to be the most conditioned team in the country, he's trying to at least hold them to it. They look like they're outlasting people, which when you're going into Arizona and playing when it's, I mean, I think the field temp was like 104 degrees or something ridiculous like that. You're going in and you're, you know, looking more conditioned, better conditioned than the guys that live in that environment. That says something about your team's condition.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, they, you know, honestly, my hat's off to them. They were awesome. I know that the defense gave up points, but it was just such a fun game to watch, and I'm so glad that they came out with the win, and they just really, they battled. They battled through it.
Yeah, they did. And before we, you know, kind of talk about what this win changes for our projections for the season, I gotta tip my hat off to Jane Daniels. I mean, he's going to be a pain in everybody's ass for the next 3 years after this. He's for a true freshman. I mean, he looks pretty damn solid. He threw for 345 yards. He did have that one pick, but again, I think that was more on Rakestraw making a crazy play than Jane Daniels, you know, just throwing it. It wasn't such a horrible throw that it was an obvious pick. So, I mean, he played pretty well. And while we're talking about Jane Daniels, it was nice to see a running quarterback not take off and scramble for first downs every other play against a CU team, which I think is obviously it's a Mel Tucker team. So it's not the same as previous staffs, but that's something that's been a thorn in CU side for many years. And it was nice to see him not get out of the pocket and just dominate.
Yeah. Thank God. Right. I mean, look, Jane Daniels is legit. He overthrew a couple of guys early, I think on deep balls that had a chance to be big plays for them, but he did. I mean, he made some throws. Like I said, that one touchdown, I think it was in the second half, he threw an absolute dime to his receiver in the end zone, just dropped it right into him. So he has obvious talent. I think as time goes on, he's just going to get better and better. I'm kind of glad that they played him early in the year, to be completely honest. But yeah, so he was legit. I thought as far as ASU goes, it seems like their defense might not be exactly what everyone thought it was. I mean, I think they're a talented unit, but clearly, I mean, we were cutting through them pretty easy early on. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see what that team looks like going forward. Cause before this game, the question was the offense, not the defense, and the offense showed that they can play. So, it'll be interesting to see what they can do.
Yeah, I now that you mentioned it, I think you're kind of starting to show that you're kind of a prophet. I mean, you called how Stanford's hype was kind of bullshit. You called that on UCLA and you called it on Arizona State's defense. You're 3-for-3 on the heavy takes this year. I think you got to keep that up.
We'll see about that. Sometimes it's better to be lucky than good, you know? So, so we'll see. But, you know, I mean, they hadn't really played teams that I would call offensive juggernauts going in. So I was interested to see what it would look like. And I think CU, you know, I mean, hey, maybe they are a really good defense and CU's offense just looked that good tonight. But yeah, I'll definitely be keeping an eye on them to see how they look going forward.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you said, it could be CU's offense just looked that good. But, you know, like we mentioned last week, you live and die by Montez. And I mean, if he plays like that every game, CU's going to have a chance to win every single game for the rest of the year. It's just if he can keep that, you know, keep that. It seemed like he was just more focused this week. If he can keep that focus and keep those, I mean, he didn't look like he had happy feet in the pocket. So if he can keep that going, that bodes really well for CU's chances to compete for, you know, I mean, at this point now, maybe compete for the South with Utah losing.
Yeah. I mean, I think the team is going to, like I said last week, a couple of times, they're going to go as Montez goes. So it was great to see him have a bounce back game. And I hope he keeps it up. I hope he keeps up the focus and I hope the offensive line keeps up their play, because if they do, honestly, I mean, who knows what the limit is to this team here, because they were cruising last night.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess that kind of brings us, I think we kind of wanted to revisit our preseason predictions and kind of see if how we view things now that we're four games into the season. And I hope you remember, I think I said 7-5, but I'm actually not
positive. I think we both said 6-6. I think that was our overall prediction, was 6-6. I don't remember the exact games we picked wins and losses for, but I think in the end we both ended at 6-6. I think we picked slightly different games, but
yeah. So I mean, I guess I'll just let you start and kind of, you know, what's changed from then to now on how you view the rest of CU's year finishing.
All right. Well, so for me, I know I said in the first pod we had definite potential. But there was also potential to you know, only win, I think we said like two wins, three wins was a possibility. So it's great to see him get three wins early. I think the way that I looked at the rest of the season, I divided it into essentially four different groups as far as the games that they have left to play. So if you look at the rest of the way, they've got three wins that I would say are like very, very possible, that honestly you could argue they should win. So if you look at, they got Stanford at Folsom, they've got Arizona at Folsom coming up in their next game after their bye, and then they've got UCLA away. So all three of those games, like, I feel like they should probably win those, which gets you to a bowl if you win all three of those games at this point. So that's a really good feeling for me. After that, I said you've got two more wins that I would consider to be like tough, but not totally out of the question. With USC at home, you know, who knows what their quarterback situation is going to look like at that point. We still don't really know who they are as a team. I almost feel like any given day they could be the team that lost to BYU and struggled with Fresno State, or they can be the team that beat Utah and smoked Stanford. So I feel like there's potential there. And with Washington State losing to UCLA, I mean, why can't we win at Washington State, you know? So
yeah,
tough, but not crazy. That would be two more. That would get them to eight. That would be like my beyond my wildest dreams. Before the season started, I would be ecstatic with eight wins. And then you've got like an unlikely wins. You know, you got like Washington at home. At least they're at home, but Washington's a good team. That would be tough. And then what I would still categorize as very unlikely would be Oregon away and Utah away. So I think there's an obvious path to six wins here, and eight is very possible.
Yeah, I actually, before I mention what my thoughts are, it's cool to see, obviously we're one game into the conference, but see you second in the South.
There you go.
I mean,
sitting
they're second there. In the South. So who would have thought, you know, at the beginning of this year, I definitely wouldn't have thought that at any point in the season, see you'd be second in the South. But obviously, like we said, it's first game of the conference. USC has played two, so they're obviously in the top at 2-0. But yeah, I totally agree with the three wins that I think are almost not sure wins, but I think that CU's just got. I think CU's gonna be favored in those games. I think they have a really good shot, especially because the two tougher of the three, I would say, are both in Boulder.
Right.
Arizona, I think they can win pretty handily. UCLA, you know. Like we said, we don't really know what they are after that Washington State game, but I still think they're pretty bad. And Stanford, if they can't score, they're not going to be able to keep up with CU's offense. And so I actually changed a little bit. I still think, like you said, Oregon is a very unlikely win.
Right.
I don't think there's much chance there. Washington State, my whole thing with them, and I thought this at the beginning of the season, I thought, you know, Air Raid team, Mike Leach-led team, they're just going to drop dimes all over us. It's not even going to be close. I think if CU's offense can hang, you know, relatively close for the first half, and then if the staff keeps up these crazy halftime adjustments, then maybe they come out in the second half against Washington State and they can corral them enough to let the CU offense take care of business. So I moved Washington State from an unlikely win to there's a chance.
Right.
And I also moved Utah from unlikely to there's a chance because their defense showed their weaknesses, the secondary, sure, which CU's receivers is definitely their strength. Sure. So I still think that Utah's going to be favored in that game. But other than that, I think USC and Boulder, I'm going to go ahead and say that right now, if I could put a guess on it, that game is going to be a 3-point favorite. Or whoever's favorite is going to have it's going to be a 3-point swing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then Washington, you know, again, I want to see them against a team with a legitimate defense. I want to see them against a team with a legitimate offense because I don't think they've played a team that really has the talent to try and test that defense that they'll see, you know, in the caliber of the Pac-12. Who knows? I could be completely wrong, but I mean, I guess if you count Hawaii as that team, I don't. So it'll be interesting to see, but I still categorize Washington as unlikely. So for me, I'm still thinking 7-5, but I think the ceiling raised from 8 wins to 9.
Okay. Yeah. You know, I could see that for sure. And I do want to point out, and I'm not saying this is going to happen, but there is a path where Colorado, they take care of business against Arizona at home. They go to Oregon, they lose. But after the Oregon game, they're sitting at 4-2. And if they could pull off an upset against Washington State, then you're looking at 5-2. They play USC at home. They could be 6-2. And then you've got UCLA and Stanford. And they could be 8-2 going into a game against Washington in Folsom. So I'm not saying that's going to happen. It's pretty unlikely. But there is a path where we could be looking at some seriously fun times come the end of the year here.
Yeah, and I think college football is such a momentum-driven game. If CU were to be 8-2 heading to that game,
it'd be interesting.
Talent differential aside, it's going to be a good game.
So,
and to mention, you know, UCLA, I think we're trying to figure out a way for Max and I and Josh to get up to the UCLA game so we could see you guys, and I think that'd be a fun one to watch when it is a very legitimate chance at bowl eligibility that time.
It could be.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if we can get out there. I really hope we can. I love going to the Rose Bowl, but we'll see. So I don't know. I mean, it's just funny because last week I would never have said that the ceiling race from 8-9, but it's just that's how college football is. You know, one week changes your entire perception of a season. Totally,
100%.
So now that we kind of have gone through what we think is gonna what our revamped predictions are. I before we get into those common segments we always do, we just want to go through, you know, Pac-12 week 5, any games that are sticking out to you for next week since CU has a bye.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think it's a pretty good slate. So you've got ASU versus Cal, I think it's going to be interesting, just because let's see how ASU rebounds. Is their offense still going to look good? Cal, is their offense going to look like it did against Ole Miss? You know, are they going to be able to keep just chugging along, winning game after game, surprising everyone, you know? So it'll be an interesting one. And then the one I think I'm probably most interested to see right now is USC versus Washington, because now you're looking at, is USC their third string quarterback? You know, is this legit or is it not? You know, is Washington going to keep rolling, or is USC going to beat them too? So,
yeah, I think that maybe USC is that first chance to really see an offense that's, you know, a legitimate offense potentially going up against that Washington defense. And so it'll be interesting to see that, how that turns out. I have a feeling it'll be, is that game, it's in Seattle, correct?
Yes, it is. It's in Seattle.
Okay. Yeah, so I'm assuming Washington will come out probably a touchdown favorite, right. But it'll be, and maybe actually the line's out. I didn't even take a look at that one. So
yeah, I think I've got that one actually for later on, but yeah.
Okay. And then the one I want to watch most, aside from the Washington USC game, is I want to see USC or Utah and Washington State. I want to see if Utah can figure out the issues they had against USC's passing attack, and if Washington State figured out exactly how to exploit the Utah defense. Because, you know, regardless of what you say about Washington State's defense, their offense is legit. And if they have figured out, if USC figured out the blueprint for Utah's defense, then Washington State will have a field day with it if Utah can't get that adjusted.
Agreed. I actually think this is an interesting one because it could be a bad matchup for Utah, honestly. They just got kind of torn up by a team that just pass. And, you know, that's where Washington State is most comfortable. So it's going to be really interesting to see how they handle that. I mean, I don't think Utah's offense is built to survive a shootout. So they're going to need to figure out something on defense. Even though Washington State's coming off a loss to UCLA, I almost feel like that makes it a little bit scarier because, you know, you've got Utah who had championship aspirations. They just blew it. So they might be even down. And then you've got Washington State, who's this team that I feel like is kind of built to exploit their weaknesses here. So it's going to be an interesting one for them.
Yeah. And then it'll be interesting to watch the battle of the bottom two in the South, UCLA taking on Arizona in Tucson. I have a feeling that one's going to be an ugly game. But, I mean, who knows? It could be another basketball type game for UCLA, since I don't think either of those defenses are very solid.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting because Arizona seemed like they might have had a defense in their last game against Texas Tech. So you know, I'm kind of, it's weird to be excited about a game between two teams that are at the bottom, but I am kind of interested, especially since, you know, Arizona is the next team the Buffs play. So to see how they come out against this UCLA team coming off a huge, huge win is going to be a good one.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. So since, I mean, it's a small week, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 games. So CU's off. And then who is the other team that is off? It is.
Is it Arizona State?
I can't even see. No, they're out. They're on.
That's right. I already said.
So, man, this is tough. So in the South, you got UCLA, Arizona, SC, Cal, or not Cal, ASU going. So in the North, it's Oregon that's off.
Right. Okay. Right. There you go.
So two teams off. And I don't know if that's protocol. I don't know if that's standard to have two teams off every week. But I mean, 5-game Pac-12 schedule.
Yeah, so. Either way, bye's coming at a perfect time. It could not be coming at a more perfect time for CU here with the injuries.
CU really needs to recover.
Bye is coming in clutch.
Yeah, it did. And then I didn't realize CU has two byes actually this year. And I'm trying to figure out 10. It looks like the week between Stanford and Washington is another bye, which I think is huge, especially if CU is able to either be 7-3 or 7-3. No,
7-2?
I can't do math.
At that point?
7-2 or 7-2.
Yeah, that would be sweet. That would be amazing. Yeah. But, yeah.
Regardless, going against Washington and Boulder, that's going to be huge to have it then. The byes could not have really played out more perfectly this year than they did. So that's exciting to see.
Yeah, absolutely. It's honestly kind of a stroke of luck with how hard the schedule is shaped up to be, you know, that this came just right at the perfect time.
Yeah. So to get on to the next part, we're going to go over our bets of the week. Like you said, we were 5-6 last week, so that's not terrible.
No, that's very good. Okay, that's winning money, 5-6.
If I would have just followed just those six bets, I would have won money. I just happened to take a couple others. Looking at you, Georgia, throwing that. I thought I could get away with that 14.5 spread.
Not
but
quite.
No, and I don't know if that was Notre Dame being better than I thought or just Georgia trying to just slow down the game. That's not really.
Yeah, that's we'll see that one in the coming weeks, I guess.
Yeah. So, Chase, I'll kind of let you get started with the three you think are good bets to take this week.
All right. So I honestly had a bit of a tough time with this week. There were three that jumped out at me pretty quickly last week that I felt good about. But this week, it's a little tougher. But I went with my first pick is Penn State away versus Maryland. They are a 6.5-point favorite. Personally, I don't think Maryland is that good. And I think Penn State's a better team. I mean, they're number 13. I think they could win by a touchdown. I like that I'm getting that extra 0.5 back. So I would take that. The other one I have is Notre Dame at home versus Virginia. It's a big spread. They're 11-point favorites, but I think they showed against Georgia that they're better than people thought. And Virginia just struggled with Old Dominion at home. So I think that there's some blowout potential there. And then the last one I had, which is a little risky, but I think that it can be justified here, is Washington at home. The spread is bigger than I anticipated. I think it's -8 or -9, depending on where you look at it and where you're getting it. I wouldn't be surprised if it creeps down, so you might want to wait on it.
It's actually jumped up since you saw it. It's now 9.5 Washington.
Man, see, so that's tough. But my thinking here is USC, they're probably going to be with their third string quarterback. I don't think you can get away with just passing it all over Washington. I think their secondary is better than what they saw against Utah. Also, USC is going to have to go away from home, which is also where their only loss was against a BYU team that Washington just went to BYU and beat the hell out of. So I think there's still some potential there. I don't think that Fink is going to get away with tossing up 50-50 balls with Washington secondary, how disciplined they normally are. So I really think Washington could win that game by 10 or more. I think USC, after such a big win against such a big program, I think they're kind of primed to have a letdown here. So those are my three.
Okay. I mean, I like all three of those. I think all three of those are actually really solid. And I didn't even see the Penn State Maryland line, so I'm going to definitely jump on
that. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Definitely jump on it as soon as you can. I wouldn't be surprised if that one goes up. I think that's kind of a mistake there.
Yeah. So I picked three. I actually picked out four. I'll run through two of them real quick, and then the other one I'll go into a little bit more of a depth. But the first one I took was Navy at 11.5 against Memphis, because, you know, it's another triple option team, and they always keep it close, especially against teams that aren't like, then don't have a massive talent advantage.
Sorry, are they plus 11.5? Okay, yes, cool. They're so getting 11.5.
They're plus
okay,
11.5. Cool. Yeah. That's a Thursday night game. It's going to be the only game on TV. It's a big game for both of those teams. I don't think that Memphis is so advanced, so talented. Like, you know, there's not such a huge talent differential that they're going to blow Navy out of the water. And, you know, triple option team, they keep it close. They keep it going. Like, the games go fast because they're just running the clock so much. So I think 11.5 for Navy is a good deal. The next one I took was Ohio State minus 16 against Nebraska.
16? Nebraska. 16 already? Man, that thing, I think opened at like 13 or 14, but yeah.
Yeah. I mean, say what you want about Nebraska's yardage and offense against Illinois. You know, at this point, you just have to realize turnovers are a part of them as a team. They can't hold on to the football. And against a team like Ohio State, that is not going to fly. So I feel like, I mean, when you only beat the worst team in your division in Illinois, or at least in my opinion, probably the worst team in their division by, what was it, 4 points, I don't see them even having a prayer's chance against Ohio State. I'm pretty pissed that game day is going there because, you know, there's got to be another game like that you could put up. But again, the slate this month or this week is not great, so... You know, I could see it. They always do fill their stadium up.
Yeah, I was going to say, they like going to games at Lincoln. So,
yeah, it'll be fun to watch them get beat down on national television on game day. So I took that one. And then this is the one I think you're going to question me on. And I understand, but I'm not saying this is even a good bet, but I really have a good feeling about Oregon State plus 3 against Stanford.
Man, that was a tough one for me. I looked at it, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think Oregon State, excusing the game that shall not be mentioned from last year, I think they're due for a game against a Pac-12 team where they just, you know, they just play them straight up and they win. There's no like, there's no letdown, there's no fluke. They just play a team straight up and they win. And I think against Stanford, who just has looked god awful, they have a legit shot. I mean, I think that Oregon State's got a good enough offense. I know they're dealing with some injuries right now, but they've got a good enough offense, and I think Stanford's offense is that piss poor that Oregon State's going to be able to come out of this one with just a straight up win. I think the plus 3 is, I mean, if when the money line comes out, I'm probably going to drop it on that too. I think Oregon State's just got a legit shot here, and I have a good feeling about it. And like I said, I don't think it's necessarily a good bet. I wouldn't necessarily follow that unless you are feeling risky, but I think they've got a good shot.
You know, I mean, it's not a bad look. It's in Corvallis, so you never know. But I honestly think it's not as out of the question as it first seems, picking Oregon State over Stanford there. But I mean, it's definitely possible because Stanford does not look good and Oregon State had a bye to prepare for it. So you never know.
So for our tweet of the week, this was amazing. And I thought at first it was kind of a joke. I really thought it was a joke, but apparently this was real. So this was Arizona Athletics, the official Arizona Athletics account, tweeted out, "This is a weird tweet to type, but the petting zoo scheduled for Arizona soccer tonight just called. The goats and sheep escaped at a previous event and are currently being chased throughout the streets of Tucson. The zoo is still happening? ? Maybe postponed a bit? ? This is all we know." That was the whole tweet, and I legitimately thought it was a joke, but no, apparently this petting zoo that was supposed to come for Arizona soccer, their goats and sheep escaped and were running throughout the streets of Tucson, which that has to have been a scene to watch. I wish I could have seen that. I'm sure there's a video of it somewhere. Yeah,
well, you know, Arizona's got problems left and right this weekend. ASU getting beat by a bus. powerhouse, and then wild animals running rampant through the streets. All hell breaks loose.
Arizona, the state, was having trouble this weekend, it seems. But I know we mentioned in the beginning we were going to go through the mailbag, but we're getting a little long here. And since we have a bye week, when we come back for next week's episode, we'll go ahead and do the mailbag then. And we have two to get to right now. So shout out to Kyle Weatherby and Kelly Magana, who is my sister, for two. They're actually two great questions. So we'll get into those next week. But as always, if you want to send us anything to go over, anything to make fun of Nebraska about, shoulder-to-shoulderpod@gmail.com. But otherwise, that's going to do it for this episode. And looking forward to a nice, deserved bye week for the Buffs.
Yes, absolutely. Subscribe. Leave some 5-star ratings. Leave some reviews. We're loving doing this. So keep listening. And thank you. And Sko Buffs.
Sko Buffs.